The Danish were just jealous. The Danske Bank report alerted hedge funds in London to an opportunity, shorting Iceland. They investigated and found this incredible web of cronyism, bankers buying stuff from one another at inflated prices, borrowing tens of billions of dollars, and relending it to the members of their little Icelandic tribe, who then used it to buy up a messy pile of foreign assets. Like any new kid on the block, says Theo Fanos of Trafalgar Asset Managers in London, they were picked off by various people who sold them the lowest quality assets, second-tier airlines, subscale retailers. They were in all the worst LBOs. But from the Prime Minister on down, Iceland's leaders attacked the messenger. The attacks give off an unpleasant odor of unscrupulous dealers who have decided to make a last stab at breaking down the Icelandic financial system, said Central Bank Chairman Udson in March 2009. The chairman of Kolpthink publicly fingered four hedge funds that he said were deliberately seeking to undermine Iceland's financial miracle. I don't know where the Icelanders get this notion, says Paul Ruddock of Lansdowne Partners, one of those fingered. We only once traded in an Icelandic stock, and it was a very short-term trade. We started to take legal action against the chairman of Kolpthink after he made public accusations against us that had no truth, and then he withdrew them. One of the hidden causes of the current global financial crisis is that the people who saw it coming had more to gain from it by taking short positions than they did by trying to publicize the problem. Plus, most of the people who could credibly charge Iceland, or for that matter Lehman Brothers, with financial crimes could be dismissed as crass profiteers, talking their own book. Back in April 2006, however, an emeritus professor of economics at the University of Chicago named Bob Alaber took an interest in Iceland. Alaber found himself at the London Business School listening to a talk on Iceland about which he knew nothing. He recognized the signs instantly. Digging into the data, he found in Iceland the outlines of what was so clearly a historic act of financial madness that it belonged in a textbook. The perfect bubble, Alaber calls Iceland's financial rise, and he has the textbook in the works, an updated version of Charles Kindleberger's 1978 classic, Manias, Panics, and Crashes. Alaber is editing the new edition. In it, Iceland, he decided back in 2006, would now have its own little box, along with the South Sea bubble and tulip mania, even though Iceland had yet to crash. For him, the actual crash was a mere formality. Word spread in Icelandic economic circles that this distinguished professor at Chicago had taken a special interest in Iceland. In May 2008, Alaber was invited by the University of Iceland's economics department to give a speech. To an audience of students, bankers, and journalists, he explained that Iceland, far from having an innate talent for high finance, had all the markings of a giant bubble. But he spoke the technical language of academic economists. Monetary turbulence and the Icelandic economy, he called his speech. In the following Q&A session, someone asked him to predict the future, and he lapsed into plain English. As an audience member recalls, Alaber said, "I give you 9 months. Your banks are dead. Your bankers are either stupid or greedy. And I'll bet they are on planes trying to sell their assets right now." The Icelandic bankers in the audience sought to prevent newspapers from reporting the speech. Several academics suggested that Alaber deliver his alarming analysis to Iceland's central bank. Somehow, that never happened. The central bank said they were too busy to see him, says one of the professors who tried to arrange the meeting, because they were preparing the report on financial stability. For his part, Alaber left Iceland thinking that he'd caused such a stir he might not be allowed back into the country. "I got the feeling," he told me, that the only reason they brought me in was that they needed an outsider to say these things, that an insider wouldn't say these things because he'd be afraid of getting into trouble. And yet, he remains extremely fond of his hosts. "They are a very curious people," he says, laughing. "I guess that's the point, isn't it?" Icelanders, or at any rate Icelandic men, had their own explanations for why, when they leapt into global finance, they broke world records. The natural superiority of Icelanders. Because they were small and isolated, it had taken 1,100 years for them and the world to understand and exploit their natural gifts. But now that the world was flat and money flowed freely, unfair disadvantages had vanished. Iceland's president, Ólafur Ragnar Grímsson, gave speeches abroad in which he explained why Icelanders were banking prodigies. "Our heritage and training, our culture and home market have provided a valuable advantage," he said, then went on to list 9 of these advantages, ending with how unthreatening to others Icelanders are. "Some people even see us as fascinating eccentrics who can do no harm." There were many, many expressions of this same sentiment, most of them in Icelandic. There were research projects at the university to explain why the Icelandic business model was superior, says Gylfi Zoega, chairman of the economics department. "It was all about our informal channels of communication and ability to make quick decisions and so forth. We were always told that the Icelandic businessmen were so clever," says university finance professor and former banker Viljalmer Bjarnason. "They were very quick, and when they bought something, they did it very quickly. Why was that? That is usually because the seller is very satisfied with the price." You didn't need to be Icelandic to join the cult of the Icelandic banker. German banks put $21 billion into Icelandic banks. The Netherlands gave them $305 million, and Sweden kicked in $400 million. UK investors, lured by the eye-popping 14% annual returns, forked over $30 billion, $28 billion from companies and individuals, and the rest from pension funds, hospitals, universities, and other public institutions. Oxford University alone lost $50 million. Maybe because there are so few Icelanders in the world, we know next to nothing about them. We assume they are more or less Scandinavian, a gentle people who just want everyone to have the same amount of everything. They are not. They have a feral streak in them, like a horse that's just pretending to be broken. After 3 days in Reykjavik, I receive, more or less out of the blue, 2 phone calls. The first is from a producer of a leading current events TV show. "All of Iceland watches her show," she says, then asks if I'd come on and be interviewed. "About what?" I ask. "We'd like you to explain our financial crisis," she says. "I've only been here 3 days," I say. "It doesn't matter," she says, "as no one in Iceland understands what's happened. They'd enjoy hearing someone try to explain it, even if that person didn't have any idea what he was talking about." Which goes to show, I suppose, that not everything in Iceland is different from other places. As I demur, another call comes from the Prime Minister's office. Iceland's then Prime Minister, Geir Harte, was also the head of the Independence Party, which governed the country from 1991 to 2009. It ruled in loose coalition with the Social Democrats and the Progressive Party. Iceland's 4th major party is the Left Green movement. That a nation of 300,000 people, all of whom are related by blood, needs 4 major political parties suggests either a talent for disagreement or an unwillingness to listen to one another. In any case, of the 4 parties, the independents express the greatest faith in free markets. The Independence Party is the party of the fishermen. It is also, as an old schoolmate of the Prime Minister's puts it to me, "all men, 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 not a woman in it. Walking into the PM's minute headquarters, I expect to be stopped and searched, or at least asked for photo identification. Instead, I find a single policeman sitting behind a reception desk, feet up on the table, reading a newspaper. He glances up, bored. "I'm here to see the Prime Minister," I say for the first time in my life. He's unimpressed. "Anyone here can see the Prime Minister. Half a dozen people will tell me that one of the reasons Icelanders thought they would be taken seriously as global financiers is that all Icelanders feel important. One reason they all feel important is that they can all go see the Prime Minister anytime they like. What the Prime Minister might say to the Icelanders about their collapse is an open question. There's a charming lack of financial experience in Icelandic financial policymaking circles. The Minister for Business Affairs is a philosopher. The Finance Minister is a veterinarian. The Central Bank Governor is a poet. Harda, though, is a trained economist, just not a very good one. The economics department at the University of Iceland has him pegged as a B-minus student. As a group, the Independence Party's leaders have a reputation for not knowing much about finance and for refusing to avail themselves of experts who do. An Icelandic professor at the London School of Economics named John Danielson, who specializes in financial panics, has had his offer to help spurned. So have several well-known financial economists at the University of Iceland. Even the advice of really smart central bankers from seriously big countries went ignored. It's not hard to see why the Independence Party and its prime minister failed to appeal to Icelandic women. They are the guy driving his family around in search of some familiar landmark and refusing, over his wife's complaints, to stop and ask directions. "Why are you interested in Iceland?" he asks, as he strides into the room with the force and authority of the leader of a much larger nation. And it's a good question. As it turns out, he's not actually stupid, but political leaders seldom are, no matter how much the people who elected them insist that it must be so. He does indeed say things that could not possibly be true, but they are only the sorts of fibs that prime ministers are hired to tell. He claims that the krona is once again an essentially stable currency, for instance, when the truth is it doesn't trade in international markets. The krona is simply assigned an arbitrary value by the government for select purposes. Icelanders abroad have already figured out not to use their Visa cards for fear of being charged the real exchange rate, whatever that might be. The Prime Minister would like me to believe that he saw Iceland's financial crisis taking shape, but could do little about it. "We could not say publicly our fears about the banks, because you create the very thing you are seeking to avoid, a panic." By implication, it was not politicians like him, but financiers who were to blame. On some level, the people agree. The guy who ran the Bauger Investment Group had snowballs chucked at him as he dashed from the 101 hotel to his limo. The guy who ran Kaupthing Bank turned up at the National Theater, and as he took his seat, was booed. But for the most part, the big shots have fled Iceland for London, or are lying low, leaving the poor prime minister to shoulder the blame and face the angry demonstrators, led by folk-singing activists Hordur Torfason, who assemble every weekend outside Parliament. Harda has his story, and he's sticking to it. Foreigners entrusted their capital to Iceland, and Iceland put it to good use. But then, on September 15, 2008, Lehman Brothers failed, and foreigners panicked and demanded their capital back. Iceland was ruined not by its own recklessness, but by a global tsunami. The problem with this story is that it fails to explain why the tsunami struck Iceland as opposed to, say, Tonga. But I didn't come to Iceland to argue. I came to understand. "There's something I really want to ask you," I say. "Yes?" "Is it true that you've been telling people that it's time to stop banking and go fishing?" A great line, I thought. Succinct. True. and to the point, but I'd heard about it third hand from a New York hedge fund manager. The Prime Minister fixes me with a self-consciously stern gaze. "That's a gross exaggeration," he says. "I thought it made sense," I say uneasily. "I never said that." Obviously, I've hit some kind of nerve, but which kind, I cannot tell. Is he worried that to have said such a thing would make him seem a fool? Or does he still think that fishing, as a profession, is somehow less dignified than banking? At length, I return to the hotel to find, for the first time in 4 nights, no empty champagne bottles outside my neighbor's door. The Icelandic couple, whom I had envisioned as being on one last blowout, have packed and gone home. For 4 nights, I have endured their orc shrieks from the other side of the hotel wall. Now all is silent. It's possible to curl up in bed with the economic theory of a common property resource, the fishery. One way or another, the wealth in Iceland comes from the fish. And if you want to understand what Icelanders did with their money, you had better understand how they came into it in the first place. The Brilliant Paper was written back in 1954 by H. Scott Gordon, an Indiana University economist. It describes the plight of the fishermen and seeks to explain why fishermen are not wealthy, despite the fact that fishery resources of the sea are the richest and most indestructible available to man. The problem is that because the fish are everybody's property, they are nobody's property. Anyone can catch as many fish as they like, so people fish right up to the point where fishing becomes unprofitable for everybody. "There is in the spirit of every fisherman the hope of the lucky catch," wrote Gordon. As those who know fishermen well have often testified, they are gamblers and incurably optimistic. Fishermen, in other words, are a lot like American investment bankers. Their overconfidence leads them to impoverish not just themselves, but also their fishing grounds. Simply limiting the number of fish caught won't solve the problem. It will just heighten the competition for the fish and drive down profits. The goal isn't to get fishermen to overspend on more nets or bigger boats. The goal is to catch the maximum number of fish with minimum effort. To attain it, you need government intervention. This insight is what led Iceland to go from being one of the poorest countries in Europe circa 1900 to being one of the richest circa 2000. Iceland's big change began in the early 1970s, after a couple of years when the fish catch was terrible. The best fishermen returned for a second year in a row without their usual haul of cod and haddock. So the Icelandic government took radical action. They privatized the fish. Each fisherman was assigned a quota, based roughly on his historical catches. If you were a big-time Icelandic fisherman, you got this piece of paper that entitled you to, say, 1% of the total catch allowed to be pulled from Iceland's waters that season. Before each season, the scientists at the Marine Research Institute would determine the total number of cod or haddock that could be caught without damaging the long-term health of the fish population. From year to year, the numbers of fish you could catch changed. But your percentage of the annual haul was fixed, and this piece of paper entitled you to it in perpetuity. Even better, if you didn't want to fish, you could sell your quota to someone who did. The quotas thus drifted into the hands of the people to whom they were of the greatest value, the best fishermen, who could extract the fish from the sea with maximum efficiency. You could also take your quota to the bank and borrow against it, and the bank had no trouble assigning a dollar value to your share of the cod pulled, without competition, from the richest cod fishing grounds on earth. The fish had not only been privatized, they had been securitized. It was horribly unfair. A public resource, all the fish in the Icelandic Sea, was simply turned over to a handful of lucky Icelanders. Overnight, Iceland had its first billionaires, and they were all fishermen. But as social policy, it was ingenious. In a single stroke, the fish became a source of real, sustainable wealth rather than shaky sustenance. Fewer people were spending less effort catching more or less precisely the right number of fish to maximize the long-term value of Iceland's fishing grounds. The new wealth transformed Iceland and turned it from the backwater it had been for 1,100 years to the place that spawned Björk. If Iceland has become famous for its musicians, it's because Icelanders now have time to play music and much else. Iceland's youth are paid to study abroad, for instance, and encouraged to cultivate themselves in all sorts of interesting ways. Since its fishing policy transformed Iceland, the place has become, in effect, a machine for turning cod into PhDs. But this, of course, creates a new problem. People with PhDs don't want to fish for a living. They need something else to do. And that something is probably not working in the industry that exploits Iceland's other main natural resource, energy. The waterfalls and boiling lava generate vast amounts of cheap power, but unlike oil, it cannot be profitably exported. Iceland's power is trapped in Iceland, and if there is something poetic about the idea of trapped power, there is also something prosaic in how the Icelanders have come to terms with the problem. They ask themselves, what can we do that other people will pay money for that requires huge amounts of power? The answer was, smelt aluminum. Notice that no one asked, what might Icelanders want to do, or even, what might Icelanders be especially suited to do? No one thought that Icelanders might have some natural gift for smelting aluminum, and if anything, the opposite proved true. Alcoa, the biggest aluminum company in the country, encountered two problems peculiar to Iceland when in 2004 it set about erecting its giant smelting plant. The first was the so-called hidden people, or to put it more plainly, elves, in whom some large number of Icelanders, steeped long and thoroughly in their rich folkloric culture, sincerely believe. Before Alcoa could build its smelter, it had to defer to a government expert to scour the enclosed plant site and certify that no elves were on or under it. It was a delicate corporate situation, an Alcoa spokesman told me, because they had to pay hard cash to declare the site elf-free. But, as he put it, we couldn't as a company be in a position of acknowledging the existence of hidden people. The other, more serious problem was the Icelandic male. He took more safety risks than aluminum workers in other nations did. In manufacturing, says the Alcoa spokesman, you want people who follow the rules and fall in line. You don't want them to be heroes. You don't want them to try to fix something it's not their job to fix, because they might blow up the place. The Icelandic male had a propensity to try to fix something it wasn't his job to fix. Back away from the Icelandic economy, and you can't help but notice something really strange about it. The people have cultivated themselves to the point where they are unsuited for the work available to them. All these exquisitely schooled, sophisticated people, each and every one of whom feels special, are presented with two mainly horrible ways to earn a living: trawler fishing and aluminum smelting. There are, of course, a few jobs in Iceland that any refined, educated person might like to do. Certifying the non-existence of elves, for instance. This will take at least 6 months. It can be very tricky. But not nearly so many as the place needs, given its talent for turning cod into PhDs. At the dawn of the 21st century, Icelanders were still waiting for some task more suited to their filigreed minds to turn up inside their economy so they might do it. Enter investment banking. For the fifth time in as many days, I note a slight tension at any table where Icelandic men and Icelandic women are both present. The male exhibits the global male tendency not to talk to the females, or rather not to include them in the conversation, unless there is some obvious sexual motive. But that's not the problem, exactly. Watching Icelandic men and women together is like watching toddlers. They don't play together, but in parallel. They overlap even less organically than men and women in other developed countries, which is really saying something. It isn't that the women are oppressed, exactly. On paper, by historical global standards, they have it about as good as women anywhere. Good public health care, high participation in the workforce, equal rights. What Icelandic women appear to lack, at least to a tourist who has watched them for all of 10 days, is a genuine connection to Icelandic men. The Independence Party is mostly male. The Social Democrats, mostly female. On February 1, 2009, when the reviled Geir Harde finally stepped aside, he was replaced by Johanna Sigurðardóttir, a Social Democrat, and Iceland got not just a female prime minister, but the modern world's first openly gay head of state. She is married to another woman. Everyone knows everyone else. But when I ask Icelanders for leads, the men always refer me to other men, and the women to other women. It was a man, for instance, who suggested I speak to Stefan Olfsson. Lean and hungry-looking, wearing genuine rather than designer stubble, Olfsson still looks more like a trawler captain than a financier. He went to sea at 16, and in the off-season, to school to study fishing. He was made captain of an Icelandic fishing trawler at the shockingly young age of 23, and was regarded, I learned from other men, as something of a fishing prodigy, which is to say he had a gift for catching his quota of cod and haddock in the least amount of time. And yet, in January 2005, at 30, he up and quit fishing to join the currency trading department of Landsbanki. He speculated in the financial markets for nearly 2 years until the great bloodbath of October 2008, when he was sacked, along with every other Icelander who called himself a trader. His job, he says, was to sell people, mainly his fellow fishermen, on what he took to be a can't-miss speculation. Borrow yen at 3%, use them to buy Icelandic kroner, and then invest those kroner at 16%. I think it is easier to take someone in the fishing industry and teach him about currency trading, he says, than to take someone from the banking industry and teach them how to fish. He then explained why fishing wasn't as simple as I thought. It's risky, for a start, especially as practiced by the Icelandic male. You don't want to have some sissy boys on your crew, he says, especially as Icelandic captains are famously manic in their fishing styles. I had a crew of Russians once, he says, and it wasn't that they were lazy, but Russians are always at the same pace. When a storm struck, the Russians would stop fishing because it was too dangerous. The Icelanders would fish in all conditions, says Stefan. Fish until it is impossible to fish. They like to take the risks. If you go overboard, the probabilities are not in your favor. I'm 33, and I already have two friends who have died at sea. It took years of training for him to become a captain, and even then it happened only by a stroke of luck. When he was 23 and a first mate, the captain of his fishing boat quit. The boat owner went looking for a replacement and found an older fellow, retired, who was something of an Icelandic fishing legend, the wonderfully named Snorri Snorrason. I took two trips with this guy, Stefan says. I have never in my life slept so little, because I was so eager to learn. I slept 2 or 3 hours a night because I was sitting beside him, talking to him. I gave him all the respect in the world. It's difficult to describe all he taught me. The reach of the trawler. The most efficient angle of the net. How do you act on the sea? If you have a bad day, what do you do? If you're fishing at this depth, what do? If it's not working, do you move in depth or space? In the end, it's just so much feel. In this time, I learned infinitely more than I learned in school. Because how do you learn to fish in school? This marvelous training was as fresh in his mind as if he'd received it yesterday, and the thought of it makes his eyes mist. You spent 7 years learning every little nuance of the fishing trade before you were granted the gift of learning from this great captain? I ask.
Yes.
And even then, you had to sit at the feet of this great master for many months before you felt as if you knew what you were doing.
Yes.
Then why did you think you could become a banker and speculate in financial markets without a day of training?
That's a very good question, he says. He thinks for a minute. For the first time this evening, I lack a word.
As I often think I know exactly what I am doing, even when I don't, I find myself sympathetic.
What exactly was your job?
I ask, to let him off the hook, catch and release being the current humane policy in Iceland.
I started as a...
Now he begins to laugh.
An advisor to companies on currency risk hedging. But given my aggressive nature, I went more and more into plain speculative trading.
Many of his clients were other fishermen and fishing companies, and they, like him, had learned that if you don't take risks, you don't catch the fish.
The clients were only interested in hedging if it meant making money, he says, and begins to laugh hysterically.
Did you even like banking? I ask.
I never had any respect for bankers, he says, still gasping for breath. To this day, one of my favorite phrases is, never trust a banker.
In retrospect, there are some obvious questions an Icelander living through the past 5 years might have asked himself. For example, why should Iceland suddenly be so seemingly essential to global finance? Or why do giant countries that invented modern banking suddenly need Icelandic banks to stand between their depositors and their borrowers to decide who gets capital and who does not? And if Icelanders have this incredible natural gift for finance, how did they keep it so well hidden for 1,100 years?
At the very least, in a place where everyone knows everyone else or his sister, you might have thought that the moment Stefan Olfsen walked into Landsbanki, 10 people would have said, Stefan, you're a fisherman.
But they didn't. To a shocking degree, they still don't. If I went back to banking, says the Icelandic cod fisherman, now wearing an entirely straight face, I would be a private banking guy.
Back in 2001, as the internet boom turned into a bust, MIT's Quarterly Journal of Economics published an intriguing paper called Boys Will Be Boys, Gender, Overconfidence, and Common Stock Investment. The authors, Brad Barber and Terence Odine, gained access to the trading activity in over 35,000 households and used it to compare the habits of men and women. What they found, in a nutshell, is that men not only trade more often than women, but do so from a false faith in their own financial judgment. Single men traded less sensibly than married men, and married men traded less sensibly than single women. The less the female presence, the less rational the approach to trading in the markets. One of the distinctive traits about Iceland's disaster and Wall Street's is how little women had to do with it. Women worked in the banks, but not in the risk-taking jobs. As far as I can tell, during Iceland's boom, there was just one woman in a senior position inside an Icelandic bank. Her name is Kristin Pettersdóttir. And by 2005, she had risen to become deputy CEO for Kaupthing in London. The financial culture is very male-dominated, she says. The culture is quite extreme. It is a pool of sharks. Women just despise the culture. Petter's daughter still enjoyed finance. She just didn't like the way Icelandic men did it. And so, in 2006, she quit her job. "People said I was crazy," she says, but she wanted to create a financial services business run entirely by women, to bring, as she puts it, more feminine values to the world of finance. Today, her firm is, among other things, one of the very few profitable financial businesses left in Iceland. After the stock exchange collapsed, the money flooded in. A few days before we met, for instance, she heard banging on the front door early one morning and opened it to discover a little old man. "I'm so fed up with this whole system," he said. "I just want some women to take care of my money." It was with that in mind that I walked on my last afternoon in Iceland into the Saga Museum. Its goal is to glorify the sagas, the great 12th and 13th century Icelandic prose epics, but the effect of its life-size dioramas is more like that of modern reality TV. Not statues carved from silicone, but actual ancient Icelanders, or actors posing as ancient Icelanders, as shrieks and blood-curdling screams issue from the PA system. A Catholic bishop named Jón Arason having his head chopped off, a heretic named Sister Katrine being burned at the stake. A battle scene in which a blood-drenched Viking plunges his sword toward the heart of a prone enemy. The goal was verisimilitude, and to achieve it, no expense was spared. Passing one tableau of blood and guts and moving on to the next, I caught myself glancing over my shoulder to make sure some Viking wasn't following me with a battle axe. The effect was so disorienting that when I reached the end and found a Japanese woman immobile and reading on a bench, I had to poke her on the shoulder to make sure she was real. This is the past Icelanders supposedly cherish, a history of conflict and heroism, of seeing who is willing to bump into whom with the most force. There may be plenty of women in it, but it is chiefly a history of men. When you borrow a lot of money to create a false prosperity, you import the future into the present. It isn't the actual future so much as some grotesque silicone version of it. Leverage buys you a glimpse of a prosperity you haven't really earned. The striking thing about the future the Icelandic male briefly imported was how much it resembled the past that he celebrates. I'm betting, now they've seen their false future, the Icelandic female will have a great deal more to say about the actual one. Part 2. And they invented math. After an hour on a plane, two in a taxi, three on a decrepit ferry, and then four more on buses driven madly along the tops of sheer cliffs by Greeks on cell phones, I rolled up to the front door of the vast and remote monastery. The spit of land poking into the Aegean Sea felt like the end of the earth, and just as silent. It was late afternoon, and the monks were either praying or napping, but one remained on duty at the guard booth to greet visitors. He guided me along with seven Greek pilgrims to an ancient dormitory, beautifully restored, where two more solicitous monks offered ouzo, pastries, and keys to cells. I sensed something missing, and then realized no one had asked for a credit card. The monastery was not merely efficient, but free. One of the monks then said the next event would be the church service, Vespers. The next event, it will emerge, will almost always be a church service. There were 37 different chapels inside the monastery's walls. Finding the service is going to be like finding Waldo, I thought. "Which church?" I asked the monk. "Just follow the monks after they rise," he said. Then he looked me up and down more closely. He wore an impossibly long and wild black beard, long black robes, a monk's cap and prayer beads. I wore white running shoes, light khakis, and a mauve Brooks Brothers shirt, and carried a plastic laundry bag that said Eagles Palace Hotel in giant letters on the side. "Why have you come?" he asked. That was a good question. Not for church. I was there for money. The tsunami of cheap credit that rolled across the planet between 2002 and 2007 has just now created a new opportunity for travel, financial disaster tourism. The credit wasn't just money, it was temptation. It offered entire societies the chance to reveal aspects of their characters they could not normally afford to indulge. Entire countries were told, "The lights are out. You can do whatever you want to do, and no one will ever know." What they wanted to do with money in the dark varied. Americans wanted to own homes far larger than they could afford, and to allow the strong to exploit the weak. Icelanders wanted to stop fishing and become investment bankers, and to allow their alpha males to reveal a theretofore suppressed megalomania. The Germans wanted to be even more German. The Irish wanted to stop being Irish. All these different societies were touched by the same event, but each responded to it in its own peculiar way. No response was as peculiar as the Greeks, however. Anyone who had spent even a few days talking to people in charge of the place could see that. But to see just how peculiar it was, you had to come to this monastery. I had my reasons for being here, but I was pretty sure that if I told the monk what they were, he'd throw me out. And so I lied. "They say this is the holiest place on earth," I said. I'd arrived in Athens just a few days earlier, exactly 1 week before the next planned riot, and a few days after German politicians suggested that the Greek government, to pay off its debts, should sell its islands, and perhaps throw some ancient ruins into the bargain. Greece's new socialist prime minister, George Papandreou, had felt compelled to deny that he was actually thinking of selling any islands. Moody's, the rating agency, had just lowered Greece's credit rating to the level that turned all Greek government bonds into junk, and so no longer eligible to be owned by many of the investors who owned them. The resulting dumping of Greek bonds onto the market was, in the short term, no big deal, because the International Monetary Fund and the European Central Bank had between them agreed to lend Greece, a nation of about 11 million people, or 2 million fewer than Greater Los Angeles, up to $145 billion. In the short term, Greece had been removed from the free financial markets and become a ward of other states. That was the good news. The long-term picture was far bleaker. In addition to its roughly $400 billion and growing of outstanding government debt, the Greek number crunchers had just figured out that their government owed another $800 billion or more in pensions. Add it all up, and you got about $1.2 trillion, or more than $250,000 for every working Greek. Against $1.2 trillion in debts, a $145 billion bailout was clearly more of a gesture than a solution. And those were just the official numbers. The truth is surely worse. "Our people went in and couldn't believe what they found," a senior IMF official told me, not long after he'd returned from the IMF's first Greek mission. The way they were keeping track of their finances, they knew how much they had agreed to spend, but no one was keeping track of what he had actually spent. It wasn't even what you call an emerging economy. It was a third world country. As it turned out, what the Greeks wanted to do once the lights went out and they were alone in the dark with a pile of borrowed money was turn their government into a piñata, stuffed with fantastic sums, and give as many citizens as possible a whack at it. In just the past 12 years, the wage bill of the Greek public sector has doubled in real terms, and that number doesn't take into account the bribes collected by public officials. The average government job pays almost three times the average private sector job. The National Railroad has annual revenues of 100 million euros against an annual wage bill of 400 million, plus 300 million euros in other expenses. The average state railroad employee earns 65,000 euros a year. 20 years ago, a successful businessman turned Minister of Finance named Stefanos Manos pointed out that it would be cheaper to put all Greece's rail passengers into taxi cabs. It's still true. "We have a railroad company which is bankrupt beyond comprehension," Manos put it to me. "And yet there isn't a single private company in Greece with that kind of average pay." The Greek public school system is the site of breathtaking inefficiency. One of the lowest-ranked systems in Europe, it nonetheless employs four times as many teachers per pupil as the highest-ranked, Finland's. Greeks who send their children to public schools simply assume that they will need to hire private tutors to make sure they actually learn something. There are three government-owned defense companies. Together, they have billions of euros in debts and mounting losses. The retirement age for Greek jobs classified as arduous is as early as 55 for men and 50 for women. As this is also the moment when the state begins to shovel out generous pensions, more than 600 Greek professions somehow manage to get themselves classified as arduous. Hairdressers, radio announcers, waiters, musicians, and on and on and on. The Greek public health care system spends far more on supplies than the European average, and it is not uncommon, several Greeks tell me, to see nurses and doctors leaving the job with their arms filled with paper towels and diapers and whatever else they can plunder from the supply closets. Where waste ends and theft begins almost doesn't matter. The one masks and thus enables the other. It's simply assumed, for instance, that anyone who is working for the government is meant to be bribed. People who go to public health clinics assume they will need to bribe doctors to actually take care of them. Government ministers who have spent their lives in public service emerge from office able to afford multi-million-dollar mansions and two or three country homes. Oddly enough, the financiers in Greece remain more or less beyond reproach. They never ceased to be anything but sleepy old commercial bankers. Virtually alone among Europe's bankers, they did not buy U.S. subprime-backed bonds or leverage themselves to the hilt or pay themselves huge sums of money. The biggest problem the banks had was that they had lent roughly 30 billion euros to the Greek government, where it was stolen or squandered. In Greece, the banks didn't sink the country. The country sank the banks. The morning after I landed, I walked over to see the Greek Minister of Finance, George Papakonstantino, whose job it is to sort out this fantastic mess. Athens somehow manages to be bright, white, and grubby at the same time. The most beautiful, freshly painted neoclassical homes are defaced with new graffiti. Ancient ruins are everywhere, of course, but seem to have little to do with anything else. It's Los Angeles with a past. At the dark and narrow entrance to the Ministry of Finance, a small crowd of security guards screen you as you enter. Then, don't bother to check and see why you set off the metal detector. In the minister's antechamber, six women, all on their feet, arrange his schedule. They seem frantic and harried and overworked, and yet he still runs late. The place generally seems as if even its better days weren't so great. The furniture is worn, the floor linoleum. The most striking thing about it is how many people it employs. Minister Papakonstantino, it's okay to just call me George, attended NYU and the London School of Economics in the 1980s, then spent 10 years working in Paris for the OECD, Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. He's open, friendly, fresh-faced, and clean-shaven, and like many people at the top of the new Greek government, he comes across less as Greek than as Anglo, indeed, almost American. When Papa Constantino arrived here in October 2009, the Greek government had estimated its 2009 budget deficit at 3.7%. 2 weeks later, that number was revised upward to 12.5%, and actually turned out to be nearly 14%. He was the man whose job it had been to figure out and explain to the world why. The second day on the job, I had to call a meeting to look at the budget, he says. I gathered everyone from the General Accounting Office, and we started discovery process. Each day they discovered some incredible omission, a pension debt of $1 billion every year somehow remained off the government's books, where everyone pretended it did not exist, even though the government paid it. The hole in the pension plan for the self-employed was not the 300 million euros they had assumed, but 1.1 billion euros, and so on. At the end of each day, I would ask, "Okay, guys, is this all?" And they would say, "Yeah." The next morning, there would be this little hand rising in the back of the room. "Actually, Minister, there's this other 100 to 200 million euro gap." This went on for a week. Among other things turned up were a great number of off-the-books phony job creation programs. The Ministry of Agriculture had created an off-the-books unit employing 270 people to digitize the photographs of Greek public lands, the finance minister tells me. The trouble was that none of the 270 people had any experience with digital photography. The actual professions of these people were like hairdressers. By the final day of discovery, after the last little hand had gone up in the back of the room, a projected deficit of roughly 7 billion euros was actually more than 30 billion. The natural question, how is this possible, is easily answered. Until that moment, no one had bothered to count it all up. "We had no congressional budget office," explains the finance minister. "There was no independent statistical service. The party in power simply gins up whatever numbers it likes for its own purposes." Once the finance minister had the numbers, he went off to his regularly scheduled monthly meetings with ministers of finance from all the European countries. As the new guy, he was given the floor. "When I told them the number, there were gasps," he said. "How could this happen?" I was like, "You guys should have picked up that the numbers weren't right." But the problem was, I sat behind a sign that said Greece, not a sign that said the new Greek government. After the meeting, the Dutch guy came up to him and said, "George, we know it's not your fault, but shouldn't someone go to jail?" As he finishes his story, the finance minister stresses that this isn't a simple matter of the government lying about its expenditures. "This wasn't all due to misreporting," he says. "In 2009, tax collection disintegrated because it was an election year." "What?" He smiles. "The first thing a government does in an election year is to pull the tax collectors off the streets." "You're kidding." Now he's laughing at me. I'm clearly naive. The costs of running the Greek government are only half the failed equation. There's also the matter of government revenues. The editor of one of Greece's big newspapers had mentioned to me in passing that his reporters had cultivated sources inside the country's revenue service. They'd done this not so much to expose tax fraud, which was so common in Greece that it wasn't worth writing about, but to find drug lords, human smugglers, and other darker sorts. A handful of the tax collectors, however, were outraged by the systematic corruption of their business. It further emerged that two of them were willing to meet with me. The problem was that, for reasons neither wished to discuss, they couldn't stand the sight of each other. This, I'd been told many times by other Greeks, was very Greek. The evening after I met with the Minister of Finance, I had coffee with one tax collector at one hotel, then walked down the street and had a beer with another tax collector at another hotel. Both had already suffered demotions after their attempts to blow the whistle on colleagues who had accepted big bribes to sign off on fraudulent tax returns. Both had been removed from high-status field work to low-status work in the back office, where they could no longer witness tax crimes. Each was a tiny bit uncomfortable. Neither wanted anyone to know he had talked to me, as they feared losing their jobs in the tax agency. And so, let's call them Tax Collector Number 1 and Tax Collector Number 2. Tax Collector Number 1, early 60s, business suit, tightly wound but not obviously nervous, arrived with a notebook filled with ideas for fixing the Greek tax collection agency. He just took it for granted that I knew that the only Greeks who paid their taxes were the ones who could not avoid doing so, the salaried employees of corporations who had their taxes withheld from their paychecks. The vast economy of self-employed workers, everyone from doctors to the guys who ran the kiosks that sold the International Herald Tribune, cheated. One big reason why Greece has the highest percentage of self-employed workers of any European country. "It's become a cultural trait," he said. "The Greek people never learn to pay their taxes, and they never did because no one is punished. No one has ever been punished. It's a cavalier offense, like a gentleman not opening a door for a lady." The scale of Greek tax cheating was at least as incredible as its scope. An estimated 2/3 of Greek doctors reported incomes under 12,000 euros a year, which meant, because incomes below that amount weren't taxable, that even plastic surgeons making millions a year paid no tax at all. The problem wasn't the law. There was a law on the books that made it a jailable offense to cheat the government out of more than 150,000 euros, but its enforcement. If the law was enforced, the tax collector said, every doctor in Greece would be in jail. I laughed, and he gave me a stare. I am completely serious. One reason no one is ever prosecuted, apart from the fact that prosecution would seem arbitrary, as everyone is doing it, is that the Greek courts take up to 15 years to resolve tax cases. The one who does not want to pay and who gets caught just goes to court, he says. Somewhere between 30% and 40% of the activity in the Greek economy that might be subject to income tax goes officially unrecorded, he says, compared with an average of about 18% in the rest of Europe. The easiest way to cheat on one's taxes was to insist on being paid in cash and fail to provide a receipt for services. The easiest way to launder cash was to buy real estate. Conveniently for the black market, and alone among European countries, Greece has no working national land registry. You have to know where the guy bought the land, the address, to trace it back to him, says the collector, and even then it's all handwritten and hard to decipher. But, I say, if some plastic surgeon takes $1 million in cash, buys a plot on a Greek island, and builds himself a villa, there would be other records, say, building permits. The people who give the building permits don't inform the treasury, says the tax collector. In the apparently not-so-rare cases where the tax cheat gets caught, he can simply bribe the tax collector and be done with it. There are, of course, laws against tax collectors accepting bribes, explained the collector, but if you get caught, it can take 7 or 8 years to get prosecuted. So in practice, no one bothers. The systematic lying about one's income had led the Greek government to rely increasingly on taxes harder to evade, real estate and sales taxes. Real estate is taxed by formula, to take the tax collectors out of the equation, which generates a so-called objective value for each home. The boom in the Greek economy over the last decade caused the actual prices at which property changed hands to far outstrip the computer-driven appraisals. Given higher actual sales prices, the formula is meant to ratchet upward. The typical Greek citizen responded to the problem by not reporting the price at which the sale took place, but instead reporting a phony price, which usually happened to be the same low number at which the dated formula had appraised it. If the buyer took out a loan to buy the house, he took out a loan for the objective value and paid the difference in cash or with a black market loan. As a result, the objective values grotesquely understate the actual land values. Astonishingly, it's widely believed that all 300 members of the Greek Parliament declare the real value of their houses to be the computer-generated objective value. Or, as both the tax collector and a local real estate agent put it to me, every single member of the Greek Parliament is lying to evade taxes. On he went, describing a system that was, in its way, a thing of beauty. It mimicked the tax-collecting systems of an advanced economy and employed a huge number of tax collectors, while it was in fact rigged to enable an entire society to cheat on their taxes. As he rose to leave, he pointed out that the waitress at the swanky tourist hotel failed to provide us with a receipt for our coffees. "There's a reason for that," he said. "Even this